This holiday season, experience the charming destination of Ottawa, Illinois. Meander through the Kris Kringle Market, take a stroll downtown, check out the gingerbread displays, and enjoy fun shopping experiences. Plan your stay in Ottawa at visitottawail.com. Today is Wednesday. It's December 4th, 2024 at 2:39 in the afternoon. Happy holidays, and hi, this is John Williams. We are the Mincing Rascals podcast, the podcast for people who care about Chicago. Listen to me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm Marge Halperin, communications consultant with decades of experience in government reform and community activism, doing what I can to make the world a better place. Austin, I just stole your line.
Well, I thought you were finding it hard to say that because that's so difficult to do for you right now, Marge. I thought you couldn't say that and keep a straight face.
It's not easy. Challenging authority is usually my thing, but the world needs to be a better place.
I'm Austin Burke from the Illinois Policy Institute and co-founder of Iron Light, a marketing agency working to change the world. You can read my book, The New Chicago Way, Lessons from Other Big Cities.
I'm Brandon Cove with WCIU on a host of other platforms.
Hi, I'm Eric Zorn, the editor and publisher of Picayune Sentinel, powered by Substack.
Eric confessed in a Google Doc before the pod today that he's a bad citizen. Those were his words. He said he's not that interested in the case against former Illinois House Speaker Mike Madigan. Madigan's on trial for using his position to steer business to his law firm, and Eric doesn't seem to care. Neil Steinberg took a similar tone in the Sun-Times today, talking about Mayor Brandon Johnson's now former communications chief, forced to resign after allegations of very bad behavior and damning tweets. Steinberg said, you know, to me, politics is like sports. It's the same thing happening over and over. And so, Eric, I think I've maybe mischaracterized your attitude somewhat. You probably care, but you're also not real animated by this story, are you?
Well, I am not animated by the trial so much. I am dutifully reading all the stories because I feel like a good citizen should. I want to take issue with Neil Steinberg's comment about sports being the same thing happening over and over again. I've chided him about that remark in the past. I think sports are fascinating, and it's not the same thing happening over and over again. And
yeah.
Just leave it there.
Are you going to talk about the Michigan game now, or are you going to move on, Eric?
I was hoping to salt that into every conversation,
yeah,
if I could. No, but you know, I mean, I read the stories and I feel, you know, Madigan's been gone now for what, 3 or 4 years. And these stories of his alleged corruption are, you know, 5, 6 years old. And it feels very much like a rerun of the ComEd trial, just a lot of the evidence. And his behavior seems reprehensible, although it's quite possible that he never exactly said or did anything that crossed the line overtly. And I just, you know, I'm reading it going like, I should really be outraged by this. I should really care about this. But I just, it feels like a real duty to read those stories. And
I completely, but don't you feel it would be easier to be outraged or feel like justice was being served if this happened 5 years ago, 10 years ago? You know, it's like Ed Burke going to jail after he wasn't all that relevant anymore. And but for 2 years, justice delayed is justice denied.
Yeah, Burke put off his trial for 5 years, I think, between the time he was pinched and the time he went to trial.
It doesn't make me happy. I've said many times that if corruption convictions helped our corruption problem, we'd be the least corrupt state, and we're not. It's because we actually have to change structurally our ethics rules in government rather than just relying on the feds to come get people. Because for one, it takes them a really long time to do that, as we've seen. The same thing happened with the longtime House Speaker of New York, Sheldon Silver. I think all the machinations of his trial took almost a decade before he ever spent time actually behind bars. So personally, it's a reminder. I was very critical of Madigan while he was in office. We wrote and produced a documentary about him. He tried to personally depose me in court for the documentary on a completely unrelated case. And this trial is a reminder to me of something sort of what Marge was talking about, like speaking truth to power. Me personally and people I work with were called like you know, MAGA, Republican, right wing, you know, racist, sexist, like all the above, for daring to challenge this guy and talk about his corruption all the time. And we were dead right about every single thing that we said about him. And regardless of whether this he is proven guilty in court. So it's a reminder to me personally about that, that you people, if you strongly believe in something and you have facts to back it up, you should speak out about it. And the pettiest thing I will be doing is buying, you can actually buy the original court sketches that are made. So I'm going to go down to the courthouse and talk to the guy who does those and buy a bunch of them next week. If anyone wants a really good Christmas gift, that's not a bad.
What a cool souvenir, in a way. I mean, maybe it doesn't have the cachet that a Blagojevich one would, but that's interesting. I can see you.
Nobody steal my idea, though. There's a limited amount.
You want a drawing of Madigan on your wall?
I don't know if I want it on my wall. My wife, when I told her, she was like, we're not putting that in our. I'm like, oh, it'll be in the office. It's in the office. It's just as a reminder. I'll probably put it in the office.
You're going to have to get it signed, Austin.
That would be interesting. And that's not, again, like as a personal, I feel no personal vindictiveness towards this person. It's simply, it's kind of hard to describe to people. I mean, all of you lived through the time when he was just untouchable, and everybody knew he was really powerful and had all sorts of, if not outrightly corrupt, very highly morally questionable dealings. That was the way it was for decades, and now it's not that way.
Do you think your wife would go for a drawing of Alderman Solis, maybe? Good stocking stuffer, that one.
Well, one last thing, though, and then I want to hear from Marge and Brandon on this, but can you put your finger on how anybody else suffered for Madigan's apparent corruption? That is, I'm not a developer of a building, so I'm not sure how any citizen is injured by this. I'm not saying he should get away with it, but it does get to Eric's point. Why do I care?
Well, why should you care? For one, I don't know if it's not necessarily like the biggest deal to as a regular concerned citizen to know every single detail of what happened, what's going on in the Madigan trial. I think what's more important is the fact that you had someone who's right now in the Illinois state legislature. We have no conflict of interest rules for legislators. It's literally an honor system. And Madigan was able to tell everyone, you know, I take the utmost care of not voting on legislation. It was literally an honor system then, and it's still an honor system today. One fascinating example that I don't think gets enough attention, State Senator Robert Martwick on the Northwest side still works as a property tax attorney. Ed Burke was a property tax attorney. Mike Madigan was a property tax attorney. So is Rob Martwick. No one ever talks about it. And the fact that I'm not saying he's doing something corrupt necessarily. What I'm saying is there are no rules in place to actually prevent him from voting on legislation that benefits the clients of that property tax law firm. And so it's just stunning to me that there's so much attention paid to the intricacies of this trial, but not to, like, you know, the actual cases of potential conflict of interest and the laws that encourage that are in place right now.
I find a couple aspects of this conversation a little troubling. For one thing, John, it's not a victimless crime. That is, when you shake somebody down, they have to pay you what you demand. Could they have gotten good representation through another attorney who, by the way, also needed business probably? So the firms who would have gotten the business didn't get it. Mm-hmm. The price paid is whatever he demanded, and I don't think he gave him a discount, you know, a good neighbor discount, probably not. So in that process, he's cheating a lot of people. And the level of corruption is so detailed. Forgive me if I've shared this before, but I don't think so. When Solis talked about when he first met Madigan, I realized I was there because it was part of the school reform movement where we were drafting the law that created local school councils.
Danny Solis was the alderman who was wearing the microphone and did the undercover work for the FBI. Go ahead.
Right. And at that time, he was with UNO, the community organizing group, and I was with a parents group called PURE, Parents United for Responsible Education, which I helped start. And so we were writing this bill, and we were crammed in an office with a limited number of people, the teachers union, the principals, and Madigan and his staff. And the next morning, we reach an agreement. The next morning, we all get copies of the bill, and there's this section in there about the local school councils can choose their principal, except in cases where in place principal graduated from a certain university in a certain a couple of years with a certain criteria, whatever. And we're like, who's that? Well, it was Shirley Madigan's best friend who was to be protected by this law so she could stay principal wherever she was.
Wow.
We got him to take it out. But that level of corruption and, self-dealing.
Hubris. Wow.
What else? What else don't we know about? I mean, that was so minor, buried in this bill. We're lucky we saw it. But I don't know where else he's been hurting people and thwarting the law for his own gain over all these years. I'm glad he's finally gotten caught. I'm sad to see Solis. I watched his career since I had met him and worked with him in those early days. And what's coming out about him will be in his obituary, and it's not a pretty story.
That's maybe why this story at least is somewhat appealing or might attract eyeballs, is because it was prostitutes, it was Viagra, it was massages, it was all kinds of just dumb stuff. But Brandon, I'll bet you're not hearing a lot of people chatting about it. I'll bet it's not a, hot topic around town, right? It's a news story, but it's not a conversation people are having, is it?
Yeah, big fat zero. Nobody's talking about this. However, that doesn't mean it's not important, right?
Yeah.
I think if we've learned anything from this election season, issues that should matter the most to people just don't float to the top of their minds or the top of their algorithms. I think it's important now more than ever that journalists and we as journalists do a better job communicating why things matter and not just assuming that our audience knows why they matter. I think the industry has a lot of just jumping into things right away. And we got to take a few steps back, remind people of some things. Because the reality is, people got a lot of other things on their mind right now, especially if you live in Chicago. The news coming out of City Hall is a lot to keep up with itself. Then you got this case as well. So I don't condemn anyone that's having a tough time following it or has not been following it. It's definitely important. As Austin says very well, corruption does have a direct impact on the livelihood of Chicagoans, the taxes of Chicagoans. Anyone that cares about those things, you should be caring about this. But yeah, it's a tough thing to see float to the top of rundowns when it's on the top of people's minds right now either. And I relate to Eric. I've been keeping up with the case. In the rank of importance, it's not high up on priorities for me either.
You know, that kind of criticism was echoed, I think, in a post yesterday from Heather Cox Richardson, who was writing about how we are all transfixed by the Joe Biden pardon of his son Hunter, but we're not, A, telling that story fully and faithfully, and B, meanwhile, Pete Hegseth might become the defense secretary. Let me just transition to that for a second here, and maybe we'll come back to things Chicago in a little bit. But Pete Hegseth said today, if he becomes secretary of defense, he won't drink alcohol, which sounds to me like a tacit acknowledgement of the complaints about him. Cox Richardson wrote yesterday about his troubles. He had been forced to leave his senior position at two veterans organizations because of, quote, financial mismanagement, sexual impropriety, and personal misconduct, close quotes. She wrote, a whistleblower for the Concerned Veterans for America reported he was repeatedly so drunk at events that he had to be carried out, and once tried to join dancers on stage at a strip club to which he had brought his work team. The whistleblower said that he would divide the female staffers into two groups, the party girls and then the not party girls, and then he would pursue the former sexually, which led to charges of assault. One whistleblower said, along with his history of alcohol abuse, he used their events as opportunities to drink and hook up with women on the road. There are reports today that Trump might be reconsidering Hegseth as his pick for defense. And again, and I don't see people wrapping themselves into it either. I don't see people investing a lot of time or energy in it. For one thing, what can you do? Nothing really, except
call your senator.
Really?
Sure. If he comes to a
vote. Both of them probably will, honestly. I mean, I think at this point, his chances, if he is put up, are pretty slim. I mean, even Republicans like Lindsey Graham are cooling on the prospect of having him up there because of the things that have come out and things that have yet to come out. I mean, you got an email from his own mom Yeah. Calling him a sexual abuser. Yeah. That's pretty bad. He's about to do a Fox News interview with his mom right by his side. That's kind of odd for a top choice for a big White House position.
It seems like it was a rash decision that he wasn't very well vetted, if he's vetted at all, that Trump seems to like how people present on television, and he goes from that. And it looks to me right now that he'll somehow figure out a way, Hegseth will figure out a way to need to spend more time with his family and will bow out the way Matt Gaetz bowed out. And I just can't imagine Trump wanting this to go to a vote in the Senate, and he doesn't want to lose a vote. I don't think Trump wants to lose any votes. And if he's got his finger to the wind at all, he realizes that Hegseth will probably not be confirmed.
You guys don't think that he would get confirmation right now? Knowing what we know now, if the vote were tomorrow, you think the Senate does not confirm him?
I think not. Yeah.
Even that senator from Wyoming, the woman who I can't remember, he tried to shift the narrative by meeting with the staunchest Trump allies in the Senate and having them say positive things about him. And Loomis, is that her name, from Wyoming? She said, well, you know, if he's in the military, there are going to be some wild childs, you know, like locker room talk. They were trying to play it, you know. But even she today said, wait, this is too much. This has really gone beyond. I mean, it's as if he's chosen a cabinet of misogynists. Like, sexual abuse and harassment is a feature, not a bug. Even Linda McMahon, the education secretary nominee, has a sexual harassment scandal in that she oversaw did nothing about staffing reports about people getting harassed or abused under her authority.
I wonder where the hashtag MeToo movement is relative to all this, right? Like, is this sufficiently distanced from it? It sounds very pre-MeToo, but this is post-MeToo and not that long ago. It does seem like a lot of the people that are putting people up, hello Mayor Johnson, hello Donald Trump, aren't doing a very good Google search of these people.
You were going exactly the point I was going to make. So this is the importance of confirmation of like an independent body or somewhat independent body. This is the importance of it, because you can't trust just the executive to do all the vetting properly themselves. We saw that in Chicago, and we're seeing it at the federal level too. And so this Senate confirmation process, the difference between, I think, the cover or the attention paid to these two things, I think has something to do with the fact that Trump's decision is not final by any means. It has to go through another step of the process, which is by no means certain. Whereas the executive authority wielded by President Biden in that pardon is final. That's the law. So that's one difference. And I do think it speaks to the importance of the confirmation process. We saw this in the case of the school board president, who had all sorts of insane stuff that he was posting on social media. We saw it potentially with Ronnie Reese, who is the communications director, who was fired, and now those allegations are coming out. And that has certainly become a pattern, not just in the White House, but in City Hall.
It's possible Donald Trump didn't know this stuff either.
Very possible. I think for many of these folks, it's much more of a sort of a guts or instinctual feeling that he has about this person, and then that gets them the nomination rather than, you know, some a very large body.
Hegseth presented well on TV. He served three tours. His fellow soldiers said he was good in the field, that he was the first through the door. He got frustrated with some of the bureaucracy, which Donald Trump probably likes. Marge, you were making a face when Austin was talking.
No, when you said maybe he didn't know, which is worse, whether he knew or didn't know? What right. kind of a figure do you want as president who makes rash decisions without any substantive background check? Well, that's clearly who he is, right? So he either knew or he didn't. But either way, I think it's bad. He should have known, given how many people did know and how easy it was to tap into that background. This is a bad trend.
He is not a curious man. He didn't know.
No.
He didn't pay any attention to that stuff. Remember the days when cabinet nominees would get bounced because, like, they didn't pay a nanny tax and stuff? Those the good old days when they had actually standards. And now you've got these incredibly awful stories about these people, these you know, like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and all the weird stories about him. People are like, well, you know, but he's got some good ideas. The deference that looks like the Republicans are going to show to Trump for a lot of these picks, like Tulsi Gabbard to head the intelligence operation, is just, it's very troubling. But again, it seems like we're sort of in this whole new era of politics where it's like anything goes. People are saying that, oh, Joe Biden giving his son a pardon is going to give Trump license to pardon the January 6th rioters. That's crazy. Trump was going to do whatever he wants to do. When has Trump ever been limited by anything like this? When is there any idea that this guy's got guardrails around him? And, oh, he's going to say, well, now that the norm has been broken, I can break it further. It's nonsense. He was going to do what he was going to do, and his people were going to go after Hunter Biden the same insane way they've been going after him for the last, 10 years? And that's why I support the pardon. I said, look, I mean, he could have done it differently. I wish he had done some things differently. But just to get that off the table and protect your kid from this crazy mob of vengeance-minded people who Trump is going to put into place, that's why I thought it was a fine idea to pardon him. And I know in my click poll, something like it was 9-1 in favor of the pardon. And I think, John, in your click poll, it was 3-1 or 4-1, something like that?
3 out of 4 said they supported it.
Yeah.
Trump broke the norm, right? He did it himself. He pardoned, Kushner's father, who is now
Charlie Kushner, yeah,
in France. It's not like Hunter's going to be ambassador anywhere. He didn't get a government job. Trump's daughter made all that money off her China patents, and he pardoned Bannon and Flynn and Stone, and he could bring them all back into government now if he wants, and he might. To blame Biden for breaking a norm from a guy like that, I'm with you, Eric.
Brandon, were you in support of the pardon?
I saw no issue with it. I think ultimately it is alarming that we are at a place where, Eric said, we're in a no rules are really there type of level of politics, it seems like. That's what happens when you re-elect someone who has broken so many. And voters said they're cool with it. It makes you wonder, though, what is the line? Are there any lines at all anymore? I think what I found most, annoying about the whole fallout over Biden pardoning Hunter Biden was the finger wagging from people who are, supporters of Joe Biden and Democrats, or people that are anti-Joe Biden Democrats, saying how dare he's so terrible. What an abuse of power. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, can we look over here for a second? Where was this level of outrage? Where was this level of condemnation when a man had an angry mob attack the United States Capitol? What are we doing here? So there's so many moments lately where I just feel like I'm going crazy, and I'm living in a twilight zone and a universe where people just forget things that were so blatantly clear and obvious, and all of a sudden we're acting like they didn't happen and everything's fresh and new. You could argue that the case wouldn't have been prosecuted if Biden's name wasn't
100%. I agree. No argument here, but it was. Yeah. And he pled guilty or was found guilty. And then he paid the fine, the taxes and the penalties. And he would have to suffer whatever the consequences were of the sentencing for these things. But his dad got in front of that. I would have preferred Joe Biden to have allowed Hunter to be sentenced for the crimes for which our justice system found him guilty. It wasn't Roger Stone or Donald Trump that found him guilty. It was the jury of his peers, or it was a judge. So I say, let that play out. I'm okay with the preemptive stuff otherwise, though. That is, if Cash Patel is going to now make it his personal vendetta to get this kid even more, even though nothing has been presented. They've been working on this for years. They don't have a chargeable offense against the guy. So I could see why you'd want to say, okay, I'll pardon him for everything else, but for the two crimes for which he's been found guilty, I think he should be punished for that.
Well, they struck a deal with him. They had a plea deal where he wasn't going to have to serve any prison time, and the judge nixed it at the last minute and asked him to go back and reprocess this again. And because there was, it was too broad, and instead of just going back and smoothing it out, they decided to go after him again, hammer and tongs, and at Trump's urging on social media.
Okay, but
and
so
it
what?
It's overkill, because anyone else with his last name were Smith or Jones, he would have paid the fine. He would have had to do some civil settlement, but he wouldn't have gone to prison for this. It's they can't find any examples of anyone who is similarly convicted of these. Of a tax crime and then this minor gun registration offense, who served prison time. And so, you know, I too wish that he'd been sentenced and then Biden had just commuted his sentence. So he didn't have to go to prison. He did the crimes. There's no question about that. The crime should be on his record. The pardon erases those offenses. That's not right. I also think Biden should not have been so definitive about not pardoning him. He should have been able to see around the corner and realize what might be happening going forward and that his son was going to head to prison for this. And he should have hedged his bets. He was trying to claim the moral high ground, like we are the party that follows the law and the other party is not. That didn't matter to voters. I still don't think it matters to voters that much. But I think if he had said, we'll wait to see how this trial comes out, I'm going to evaluate it when the time comes, rather than be so definitive, because he went and he broke his word. And that's not a good look. I know. And granted, Trump lies all the time, and lying doesn't seem to have any consequence anymore either. So, you know, I'm not outraged by that. I wish he hadn't done it. But if you can claim the high ground, what good has it done you? Who cares if
exactly.
you get the high ground?
You sleep at night.
Exactly that.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, Democrats spend all the time in the world saying things like, whoa, but a dog can't drive a car. Wow, that's not possible. It can't do that. Meanwhile, the dog is running an 80 and a 30 and crashing into buildings and other cars, and nothing's being done about it. Like, they're playing on a different level of rules and playing field. It's like, if you equate it to football, it's like one team saying, oh, yeah, well, we can't do pass interference. We can't do hands to the face. We got to play by the rules. And the other one's just like, nah, no guardrails at all. One's going to have 100 points. The other's going to have 3. Like,
Did you say football?
Level playing field here, you know?
You know, he just made me think about John Mulaney's horse in a hospital bit, where he described Donald Trump's first term as, no one's seen a horse in a hospital before. Who knows what's going to happen?
You know, the one thing I would bring up, I realize it's sort of a tangent, but I wish our country had more compassion for addiction as a disease and as a tragedy in families. It's impacted my family in pretty severe ways. And I'm angry about some of the behavior under the throes of addiction, but I can't hold against people things that they did in a state where they couldn't control themselves. It's an illness. And I think we talk about it like that and we try to be morally high road on it, but we don't do enough for people with addictions. And I think that core part of the story, Biden would have done well to speak to a little more directly. Anyone who has an addict recovering or otherwise in their family is going to feel the compassion behind what he did. Some in my family paid with their lives and some did not. But it's a tragedy for a family to live through. Mm-hmm. And the repercussions for the Biden family were painfully public. And I just wish we could see it through that lens. And I think many, many Americans have the experience that I do.
100% agree with Marge. And that is one of the reasons that there are many arguments that people can make for why Joe Biden should have done this. But the one about the fact that, well, it's his son, is the one that really, there's two that really irk me. That's one of them, because there's thousands of Americans who are nonviolent drug offenders serving excessive sentences right now, and they are someone's son. There are thousands of individuals released under the CARES Act during COVID who are successfully reintegrated into society and could be reincarcerated if they do not get pardons, and they are someone's son. So when we say, oh, it's someone's son, well, no, we're saying that since it's the president's son, you know, that deserves some sort of special attention, which I totally disagree with. The other thing that irks me about it is that of the people who support the pardon, how many of them support the law under which Hunter Biden was found guilty? And President Biden supports that law, and he actually increased the penalties for violating it from a maximum sentence of 10 to 15 years. This is specifically the situation around filing untrue information in a firearm transaction, which Hunter Biden did by saying he was, you know, there's basically a box that you check around drug use. And if survey results are to be believed, there are millions of Americans who partake in drug use and have firearms and would be guilty of this. And I wouldn't say that it's something that is never charged. I think it's called Section 922 G3, and federal prosecutors filed from 2008 to 2017 an annual average of 133 charges on that charge. So I think that that's actually a bad law, and also that the pardon was bad. But I don't understand the view that the pardon is good, but I also support the law.
About the fact that it's his son, I hear your point. But I think if you just think about it, what if it were your son? I don't know what Joe Biden can do about all those other sons and fathers out there, but it's his son. He feels a personal connection to that man different than anybody else on earth. If it were your son, Austin, would you pardon him, knowing the facts of the case as you do?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I really don't know what to do. The part about it being his son, I just find, again, to Marge's point, then use it as an opportunity to talk about all of the other people whose sons have gone through this and that you have the power to help also. And as the president, it's not just your responsibility to take care of your own son, but to, you know, you have this enormous power that can affect the lives of many other people. And that was not the discussion at all. And I thought that was part of why people reacted so viscerally to it.
Well, Marge, as a communications specialist and as a political strategist, what would you have had the White House spokesperson say then when, after having just recently said, absolutely not, we will not pardon Hunter Biden, we're now going to pardon Hunter Biden? Because she said we didn't lie. I wonder how you would have massaged that message.
Well, you know, I'd have backed up to the point Eric talked about to say, no need to close the door. That's where, you know, you could say, I have no intention, or that's not, you know, in my plans, or I don't see that happening. There are a lot of ways to say it. He chose to say no.
Okay, but then after the fact, but then after the pardon, now what do you say?
So a lie is intentional. This is a debate about Trump, whether he lies or whether he believes this crap, right? But I think, you know, this is not a lie. This is a change of heart. I truly believe, I would say as his press secretary, that when President Biden said he wasn't going to, he wasn't going to. But information changes. We've seen a lot of changes in the world around us, and doing this in the context of where we are today, politically and otherwise, it felt to him like a valid decision.
Marge, I am a fan of Biden generally, and I understand your instinct there, and the spin instinct on it, but I think he was saying that. In order to draw a line between Democrats and Republicans, and to underscore his fidelity to the rule of law over anything else, in order to enhance first his electoral prospects, his reelection prospects, and then when he dropped out, to make sure that Kamala Harris was insulated from any sense that if this was going to happen, and that he should not have been so definitive about it. You can have a change of heart if you can really justify it, say, like, I was really sure because of this, and then this changed, and that's why. You can say, you know, Kash Patel being named for the FBI is terrifying for not just Hunter Biden, but a lot of people, and that would change things. But he didn't really cite that. He cited things.
Charles Kushner.
In his statement, in his statement, he talked about the things that have been sort of obvious all along, which is that this case, these guys have been after him for a long time, and that they're relentless, and that these charges seem politically motivated, given that people of his standing. And I'm not saying, by the way, that this crime, you should be able to lie with impunity on a gun application, but that the punishment up for it should not be going to prison, depending on other circumstances, obviously. But the fact that his statement really didn't say anything in it that couldn't have been said 6 months ago, that's what troubles me about this. And, you know, like I say, I wish the guy had just been honest about it up front and said, I don't know. I don't think so right now. If maybe he didn't think so, but just lying like that, you do want to have some claim to some high ground about integrity and honesty. But if that doesn't matter to voters, I guess he might as well say, like, well, screw it.
Well, that's what you were saying at the beginning of this conversation. Lying doesn't seem to matter anymore, so screw it. Wasn't right. that your take, Eric?
Well, that
you're not interested in that moral high ground anymore, that ethical standard.
Well, because voters don't seem to be interested in it.
I can't believe you're just playing the devil's advocate here. You
pretty much.
Okay, got out of that one. But I mean, I would hope so.
Couldn't you just say he's asking us to give him this one pass for all he's done in his career of public service? I'm a father. I need to do this for my son. That's basically what he said. I know I'll be judged one way or another. You could put me on the same standard, I would hope, as other presidents and the pardons they've granted.
Yeah.
And perhaps this would look a little different to you. But even if you don't, understand that I have done my best for this country, and now I'm going to do my best for my family.
Austin, do you think if Kamala Harris had won the election, Joe Biden would have pardoned his son?
Ooh. I don't know. It would have been a different pardon, I think, for sure. So, for example, this is which we haven't talked about. I mean, this excuses any behavior over a 10-year period. It's not just the behavior for which he was found guilty. And that sort of breadth, I think, is very much looking ahead towards what is to come.
Cash Patel.
Yes. Pending confirmation, as we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
I think there is still maybe some chance that on those specific charges, there would have been something issued. What do you guys think? It seems like everybody else thinks no, that he wouldn't do it.
Worked so long and so hard to find something on that laptop or some connection to Ukraine or China beyond what we know, and they haven't found chargeable evidence. So I'm willing to put that whole thing behind me. I mean, to me, that's why this thing looks back 10 years plus. Either they're going to drum up something and make his life miserable or fabricate something and send him to prison for something fantastical. And I understand that. I mean, for my son, I think I would do that. But Brandon, I'm still sending my kid to jail. It's not like he's 14. He's 50. How old is Hunter Biden? He's got gray hair. But he probably wouldn't go to jail. And if he goes to jail for 2 years, he can say hi to Ed Burke. I think then he should go to jail for 2 years.
But they weren't going to stop chasing him.
I don't think he would have got pardoned, though, if Harris would have won. I think a lot of this is about the times we're in, the vengeance that the Trump administration and his allies and the people we bring it in have talked about and professed. I think it's all attached to that. I really do.
I do, too.
I really don't see a scenario where he pardons Hunter. If Harris does win, partially because he did reach that plea deal, probably wouldn't have spelled jail time at all.
What's the guess on do the 1,500 people who stormed the Capitol? I think it's 1,500 people. That sounds high. But I've got that number in my head of people who have been charged with some sort of crime or malfeasance on January 6th. Does Donald Trump issue a blanket pardon to them?
Well, you know, I think there's a case to be made that some of the people who were convicted of trespassing, who just like went into the Capitol or wandering around and being pills, were probably overcharged. But there were people who like beat up police officers, who struck them, who maced them, who bear sprayed them, I guess. Yeah. They had. I mean, there are people who committed violent acts. And if Trump just pardons them all, I mean, what are we going to do? We're going to have a stern podcast episode about that. He'll be sorry. But I would like to think he has at one point he has said that he's going to go through case by case. Will he do that? I don't know. I think that he may just say, you know, you're all free to go. These were patriots serving in the righteous cause of my election victory that was denied to me, blah, blah, blah. That's if I had to predict, that's what I'm going to predict. He's just going to, on the first day in office, he's going to spring them all.
I think he may need them all as an army again in 4 years.
Well, you're suggesting that he's going to run again, Marge?
It does not seem clear that he wants to leave office ever. And certainly if he leaves it to Vance and Vance loses, they're going to try whatever they can to stay in office.
See, that's the thing about some of these appointments, like to the head of the FBI or any of the other agency heads or cabinet positions, that I don't worry too much about. The idea that Donald Trump would somehow usurp the Constitution and find a way to run for a third term, some people worry about that. And I don't at all. And I'm not even that certain that Pete Hegseth running the Defense Department is actually going to have an appreciable difference in the world, not in the world that I live in. I think it's very easy to whip yourself into a worry that you don't need to worry about. Maybe that's my just insulating myself from the reality of this, but I really mean that.
Well, I think a lot of voters apparently felt that way, and that's why we got the result we got.
Well, don't put me in that boat.
I don't. But I think a lot of voters thought, well, he couldn't be that bad, or he wouldn't do that again, or, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I take the stand mistrust, but verify.
It strikes me as similar to kind of the point, the discussion we were having about confirmation, which is the worry that you have with executive authority is that an executive is going to prize loyalty to them over many other things. Like, for instance, loyalty to the American people who they are there to serve. And that is definitely a weakness of Trump's, is that there's loyalty prized over, you know, any other virtue. And in the case of January 6th, I could definitely see a world where, in Trump's mind, you know, these people are just the most loyal Trump people ever, and they all deserve to be out. And that would be a very, very sad day if he does that.
Some of them have said that they really felt like it was a calling by their president to preserve the union, you know, that they really were acting patriotically. I don't care so much what they think. What they did was wrong. If they were trespassing and they are in jail or they can't vote or they were written up in their newspaper, I have zero sympathy for every single one of those people. But I also do believe that some of them actually felt that they were answering the chief executive's call to preserve the union.
Well, it wasn't a leap to think that. That's pretty much what he told them to do. Go to the Capitol and I'll be right there with you, you know, which he tried to do. So the fact that they thought it was what he wanted, was kind of what he said.
I think what I'm saying, Marge, is more than what he wanted, but more that in fact this was right, that this was the correct thing to do. If, for instance, the election really was being stolen and we really did have evidence of that, I'd march in the street too. You know, I would do something radical. So I think that some of the people's allegiance was, as much as it was to Donald Trump, of course, they really felt that this wasn't a personal calling to him. It was to America.
They were told that by Fox News. They were told that by many of their own elected leaders. They were, you know, I don't think you're wrong, John.
I don't think in 4 years, when Donald Trump is no longer the president, any of the cases that were dismissed by the Justice Department and a judge are going to come back. We don't expect that's going to happen, right?
Well, how about this? You want to guess on whether he pardons himself on his way out?
Yes or no, Trump pardons himself someday.
Say yes.
Yeah, I know. Why not? The Rascals have more to mince about, and we'll get to all of that. But first, this message about this holiday season. You can experience the charming destination of Ottawa, Illinois. Grab a mug of hot cocoa and meander through the Kris Kringle Market. Take a stroll downtown and see the gingerbread window displays. Enjoy fun shopping, too. And then take a drive to Ottawa's many parks, adorned with hundreds of festive lights. Take in a movie at the Roxy. They got first-run films in this little town. Start making holiday memories in Ottawa. Plan your stay at visitottawail.com. Brought to you by Ottawa, the middle of everywhere, and the Illinois Office of Tourism. Hey, I want to circle back to one other Chicago-based story, and then I'm going to ask you guys for your recommendations. We'll bring that back this year. Eileen O'Neill Burke is the new Cook County State's attorney. She had a press conference, and she has said things like, right now, we are having a mass shooting on a regular basis. We're becoming numb to the numbers. I don't want to become numb. I want to do something about it. She called the state's assault weapon ban, which is being challenged in a downstate federal court, a tool to address Chicago gun violence. She said, there is no doubt in my mind that the appellate courts are going to uphold the ban starting today. We are treating the possession of these weapons with the seriousness with which they demand. Her first policy directive, I'm reading from the Sun-Times now, calls for prosecutors to seek detention for every detainable felony offense which an offender used or possessed a firearm equipped with an extended magazine, drum magazine, automatic switch, or used a ghost gun or defaced a firearm. Finally, the county will also seek detention for any domestic violence related stalking or sex offense where the offender used or possessed a weapon. I just wonder how much of that she's going to be able to do with the Safety Act in place. She sounds like she's going to play much more a hardball game than Kim Fox was playing.
Is the important thing to remember about the Safety Act is that it actually requires the state's attorney, so Eileen O'Neill Burke's office, needs to say this person should be detained, and then they have to make an argument about that. And instead of setting, you know, monetary bond, where oftentimes if there's a wealthy defendant or someone wealthy wants to get them out, they can get out. The judge can say, no, this person needs to be detained. So I think it's very good that Burke is saying, we are going to seek detention for these types of things. Another one was all murder and class X felony offenses. We are going to seek detention for those people. And then the retail theft threshold, the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, currently they have a $1,000 threshold for charging felony theft. And if they have to have at least 10 prior felony convictions before being charged with felony retail theft. And they're saying, we're not doing that anymore. The law says $300. We're going to follow the law. So I think those are encouraging things and things that the state's attorney's office is well suited to do. So I think that was an encouraging sign for a lot of people in Cook County.
Yeah, I wonder how much cooperation she'll get from the judges then in all of those cases, Austin.
In theory, that's how, if you're going to remove monetary bond, that's how it should be an adversarial process. Like the state's attorney needs to prove that we really need to keep this person behind bars before trial, regardless of their ability to pay. So I think it's, in general, voters are much more interested in having a more active state's attorney's office that's saying, okay, for these people, like under the Safety Act, we're not just going to have people who can't pay bail who are stuck in jail. There has to be a really active state's attorney's office that is seeking to keep dangerous people behind bars before trial.
I seem to remember Kim Fox saying things like, in the instance where a kid rushes into a store that's been smashed and now they're grabbing, and they grab some sneakers or jewelry or clothes and they rush out, that we don't do anybody any favors by keeping that kid in jail for a year waiting for their trial. I understand both sides of that equation, but Kim Fox obviously had a much longer view about criminal justice than Eileen O'Neill Burke was articulating there.
But John, in the instance you're talking about, that is not a violent crime, I don't think. I wouldn't count it as a violent crime, someone rushing into a store, it's being looted and grabbing some stuff. So that person would be presumably released on recognizance without bail. I'm a big proponent of the elimination of cash bail. I think that the idea that if you have the money, you can be out of jail, and if you don't have the money, you have to be in jail for the same offense is offensive. But I also think that we are seeing in some of these cases, some of this like domestic violence cases that we've seen recently, that judges are not reacting strongly enough, or the prosecutors aren't arguing well enough to keep some of these dangerous people behind bars while they're awaiting trial. And so to the extent that she can cut down on these, it's not technically recidivism, but if you're arrested for a violent crime, yeah, and you're released and then you commit another violent crime, it's, you know, sort of recidivism, I suppose.
Pending trial. And, yeah, I get it.
Yeah. And I mean, to cut down on that kind of thing, for judges and prosecutors to get better about identifying people who are potentially dangerous. Not, in, you know, I don't think you should keep people for trial as a punitive matter, but as a matter of public safety, that's where it has to go. And I think I read that Austin is in favor of lowering the shoplifting threshold, and I am too. $300 is a lot of merchandise. Maybe it should be $500 or $400, something like that, given inflation.
A lot of merchandise, $300.
That is. Well, it certainly could be. It certainly is a serious crime when you're you know, you're not boosting a bottle of shampoo. You're taking, I mean, $300 is a lot of stuff, and $1,000 is a ton of stuff. And I know that the statistics that I've seen, shoplifting has gone to the roof in Chicago, and that's really tough on businesses. It's tough on the, you know, at tax rates, on taxpayers. It's a corrosive, metastatic sort of crime, and I think it's important to take it a little more seriously than Kim Fox did. I just want to add that, although I was very critical of Kim Fox with her handling of the Smollett case and some other cases, I do think that her record of going after wrongful convictions and adjusting those, erasing some wrongful convictions, has been really creditable, and that history will have that in the maybe the second paragraph of her political.
What will the first paragraph be?
But I, Jussie Smollett will always be number one.
That's a what a shame! What a shame! Because that is
on her. I think she was a good state's attorney for the most part. I mean, I there were some things I disagree with, but I think that she was really interested in justice, not just convictions.
I think you could argue she was a pretty influential state's attorney when you look at the numbers. 248 wrongful convictions overturned, first in the country to publish a public database on sentencings, 15,000 low-level cannabis convictions expunged. Like, when we talk about reforming the criminal justice system, she did a really good job working within the parameters she had of reframing how we do things. And I think the hope for some is that Eileen O'Neill Burke is tough on crime, is still able to not regress on the progress that is made and recognize that you still need to have some restorative justice. Mm-hmm. You still need to have leniency. You still need to have justice within the justice system and things like that. And she struck that tone in her remarks when she was sworn in. We got to see what she ends up doing. I do think the 300 level threshold, that's regressive. So we're going to have to see what the policies bear out. But so far, when I look at the cash bail issue and look at what she's suggesting here in terms of what she wants her prosecutors to suggest, I think that's in line with what most would do when it comes to violent offenses and what Kim Fox's office probably did as well. So it doesn't seem like it's par for the course. Fox didn't announce what she was instructing her prosecutors to do, whereas Burke is.
The thing with the $300, I don't know if $300 is the right threshold or not. I mean, a lot of people, criminal justice reform advocates, say like, well, you know, if you take a phone from a store, it's like, you know, it's $800 right there and you're facing a felony, and you got a 17-year-old kid who took a phone and he's facing a felony charge. I'm sympathetic to that. But the Burke's, I think, point during the campaign, which I agree with, was that's the job of the state legislature to set what that is. It's not the job of the state's attorney's office to set what they think the level is. And I think that's important. And the discussion around raising the felony theft threshold is suited for Springfield and not the state's attorney's office.
Yeah. You know, Austin, you were, or Brandon, you were referring to some of the things that Kim Fox said as she left office. And I don't know what they normally say in that setting, but I thought it was interesting that rather than telling about all of the convictions she got and all the people that she sent to jail, and she did mention crime is trending down, it was a lot of like, these are convictions that were overturned. It was like she was working for the not the other side, but she was talking rather about the people that are not guilty and have been released rather than people who are guilty and were jailed.
Yeah, from a law and order sense, in a traditional sense for what we think about prosecutors, then yeah, absolutely. But she came in on a mandate of reframing and switching that up. And you could argue she did that. Now, do people agree with it? That, you know, the debates are going to ensue on that. But for those who believe in criminal justice reform and progressive criminal justice reform, policing and reframing how we do it, she did a lot of good in terms of that. We can litigate Jussie Smollett and all those other cases, but she made an impact. Now we got to see what's going to happen from Eileen O'Neill Burke and those are her predecessors afterward. Across the country, not just Chicago, we've seen, thankfully, a reframing on how we view criminal justice with more of a lens toward restorative justice and rethinking how we look at these cases.
Would have liked to have heard some talk of restorative justice and how she thinks that fits into her office or her jurisdiction. She, I didn't see it in the paper. I didn't hear her whole speech, but I don't think she mentioned that. She said you could have safety and justice at the same time. I'd like to hear more about that.
I just don't think we have the patience at this moment for that sort of stuff, but I think we're cutting off our nose to spite our face if we don't. We have to find a way to have restorative justice to get to the root causes and not just think we can jail the problem. Let's wrap up the podcast with something we used to do more often, and I don't know that we'll do it every podcast, but we're going to do it today. It's the Mincing Rascals recommendations, and that is something we are eating, drinking, reading, watching, or listening to. You could, by the way, say, here was my Spotify list for the year, if you wanted to do that, because that's what people were listening to. A lot of chatter about that today. But I'll go first and say that the thing that I have been watching, I watched it last night with my son and again today, was the Yacht Rock documentary on Max. I thought that was really, really fun. I thought they were going to make fun of Yacht Rock, which is that kind of smooth jazz rock and roll that came out of California in the 1970s. And if you think of Michael McDonald, or if you think of Seals and Croft, or if you think of Toto, you are listening to Yacht Rock. And I thought they were going to, you know, make fun of it. It was all props to that genre. It was fascinating. It was really well done. And I found myself singing to the TV the way I don't normally do. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was well done. Yacht Rock, a documentary. Eric, what's your recommendation this week?
Boy, I have a bunch of them, but I'm going to stick to two. You said things you're eating, and I made macaroni and cheese for our Thanksgiving dinner for the first time. We served it. It was such a hit. I used Kate's recipe that she gave last week, and I don't know if she's willing to share it with all the listeners, but it's a great recipe, and it was a huge hit at our Thanksgiving dinner. The TV show that we just finished watching was A Man on the Inside, the Ted Danson vehicle that in which he plays a senior citizen who goes into an extended care home to try to solve. He goes undercover to try to solve a minor crime there, and it's just a delightful show. It's, I think, 8 episodes long, and it really gets into some profound issues about aging, and it features a cast of older actors, including Sally Struthers, who is who's, I don't know how old she is now, but it was really nice to see a whole bunch of old actors doing a really good job, and there's some funny moments, some touching moments, and Johanna and I were both weeping during the final episode.
So. Wow. Brandon, you'll notice that Eric didn't ask for your recipe for macaroni and cheese. Which
he wouldn't give it to me last week. He did. He refused.
Well, he did give you the key ingredient, which I believe was mustard, right, Brandon?
A little bit of ground mustard is essential. But, you know, we can swap some ideas. I can slide him a little bit. I had another great year of mac and cheese making. as far as suggestions go, I'll spare you the Spotify rap stuff because I think mine's probably different than everybody here. But as far as I'll go with something you can watch. If you're a football fan, Hard Knocks, the NFL series, is doing something different this time around. They're following a whole entire division of football, not just one team. And they're doing it in season. And so this year they're looking at the AFC North. That means the Bengals, the Browns, the Steelers, and the Ravens. And first episode just dropped last night. Let me tell you what. If you want to know why Mike Tomlin's one of the greatest coaches of all time, one of the greatest leaders of all time, same with John Harbaugh, you're going to see it in the first 20 minutes. It's really, even if you're not a football fan, I think you're going to gather something from the way these men lead their organizations, inspire confidence in the people that they're tasked with leading. There's a lot of lessons to be taken away just from episode one. It just got started. So that's my suggestion to folks.
Nice.
And that's on ESPN, is that right?
It's on Max, HBO Max.
Well, I have this disclaimer in that I watch TV mostly on the treadmill, so I need something that really keeps me focused, something I want to see on the screen over and over again. So I'm watching Cross, police procedural. It's a little intense and a little violent for me normally, but I don't look away for the most part because have you seen Aldous Hodge? So they have my attention. There are lots of people on that show, and
Marge is running faster and faster on the treadmill.
It does the job. And I'll throw in what I'm drinking because I made a cocktail last night. I am continually trying to prove the value of our favorite Chicago liqueur, Malort. Cocktail's called Hard Sell. So yeah, it's a little hard sell, but it's a cocktail with Malort in it and gin, a little lemon, a little hibiscus liqueur.
Wow.
And it was delicious with just the right bitterness for the season.
Oh, wow.
Share with Pete after the pod. Maybe we'll post it the ingredients. Like, how much of which would you mind doing that, Marge?
Yeah, sure.
Hopefully, it's not a lot of Malort, but wow.
A little more Malort than most Malort cocktails have in it.
Ooh.
But delicious. I thought it was really good.
Hard sell.
S E L L or C E L L?
S E L L. It's because, like, really?
It's a hard sell. Yeah, it is a hard sell.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, next week I will give you my recipe for the sleigh ride, which uses a sage infused simple syrup and bourbon. And that's pretty damn good. But that'll be next week. Austin, how about you? What are you recommending?
I'll say last week I rewatched this movie for the first time in a while. And I confirmed that it is one of the great masterpieces of film history. And a lot of people don't know about it. The movie's called Playtime. It's from the 60s. It's by this French director named Jacques Tati. And it was the most expensive movie ever made in France at that time. And he went bankrupt three times making it. He constructed this whole city. Every scene has like 30 to 50 extras in it. It's so crazy and beautiful and unlike any other movie I've ever seen. So I recommend that. You can buy it on Apple and Amazon, or you can get the Criterion app, which I would say another recommendation that is the best streaming app, period, for movies. And then I would say reading. I just finished this book called Music, A Subversive History by Ted Gioia. And Ted Gioia is one of the best ever writers on jazz. And this book is about like how for the last like 5,000 years of music has been so dirty and violent and sexual and mystical and weird. And like there has always been a pushback against that. But all musical innovation comes from people who don't care about status and don't compete in high status games. So it doesn't come from kings. It comes from enslaved people. That's where musical innovation comes from, or people of an underclass, or people who are downtrodden. And it tells the whole history of that over the entire history of music. It's a really good book.
Well, we got some reading and watching and drinking to do between now and next Wednesday then. Marge Halperin, Brandon Pope, Austin Berg, Eric Zorn, I'm John Williams. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. Good job, guys. We'll drop another pod on y'all next week.
Thanks, everybody. That was fun. I like the idea of doing the recommendations because I've got them piled up here. Books that I've read, shows I've watched. So if we can do it like once a month or something like that or whatever.
Yeah,
those are good. I got to watch that Hard Knocks.
That sounded good because I don't care. I knew it would be Ohio teams that would be in that division that would spark Brandon's interest. Have a good week. Happy holidays, guys.
You too. Have a good talk to you soon.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.